Our third speaker is Professor Stephen Osment, was educated at the University of Arkansas, Hendricks College, Drew Theological School, and Harvard University, with 2 years of study as well at the Institute for the Late Middle Ages and Reformation at the University of Tübingen. He received his Ph.D. from Harvard in 1967, and that year he became assistant professor of history and religious studies at Yale University, quickly becoming associate professor in 1972 and full professor in 1975. Since 1979, he has been professor of history at Harvard University. He is the author, co-author, and editor of 9 books, including The Reformation and Medieval Perspective, 1971, Mysticism and Dissent, subtitled Religious Ideology and Social Protest in the 16th Century, in 1973, The Reformation in the Cities, 1975, The Age of Reform, An Intellectual and Religious History of Late Medieval and Reformation Europe, in 1980, which was awarded the Philip Schaff Prize of the American Society of Church History. And I understand that his latest book, When Fathers Ruled, Family Life in Reformation Europe, has just been published by Harvard University Press. It's no overstatement, I think, to say that a number of these books have proved to be of seminal importance for Reformation research. So please welcome Professor Osment, who will address us on the topic Luther and the Family.
In the early 16th century, the institution of marriage was undergoing something of a crisis. According to Martin Luther, marriage had at this time universally fallen into awful disrepute. Peddlers were everywhere selling pagan books that treated of nothing but the depravity of womankind and the unhappiness of the estate of marriage. This a reference to popular misogynist and anti-marriage sentiments among Luther's contemporaries. Women in marriage were widely ridiculed in proverbs and jokes. The biblical stories of the downfall of Adam, Samson, and David at the hand of a woman had gained wide popularity. And the advocates of virginity and celibacy, both secular and clerical, provided constant reminders of the sacrifices and suffering that marriage and parenthood entailed. Now, it may seem surprising to learn that Martin Luther was a leading defender of women and marriage in the 16th century. Luther is perhaps too well known for his famous jesting comments on the meaning of woman's anatomy. Women have narrow shoulders and wide hips, he pointed out one evening at table. Therefore, they ought to be domestic. Their very physique, the fact that they have a wide rear and large hips, is a sign from their Creator that he intended for them to limit their activity to the home. That is to say, they are physically created by their Creator for sitting instead of for moving. Men have wide shoulders and narrow hips. They're made for mobility, for movement outside of the home. Women are made for domesticity. Martin Luther deserves to be better known as the century's leading critic of Aristotle's and Thomas Aquinas' depiction of women as botched males. Their creation, the alleged result of an imperfect generative act. And Luther also condemned the church fathers for allegedly never writing anything worthy about marriage. Today I'm going to deal with Luther's views and influence on family life, somewhat at a gallop, in 3 related areas. The institution of marriage, the relationship between spouses, and the rearing of children. For For Martin Luther and his followers, the cloister, with its glorification of virginity and celibacy, was a chief expression of Renaissance anti-feminism and hostility to marriage. When Protestant towns and territories suppressed monasteries and nunneries, they did so in the very sincere belief that they were freeing women from sexual repression, cultural deprivation, and domination by male clerics. It was widely believed among the leaders of the Reformation that in most cases women had been placed in cloisters without their consent and understanding, that they were more readily bullied by their monkish supervisors than were cloistered men, that they had far greater difficulty breaking their vows and returning to the world. Luther rejected the cloister altogether as a proper solution to the problem of unmarried daughters, especially the younger daughters of noblemen and wealthy burghers. And he insisted that fathers at every social rank had a godly duty to make proper marriages for all their daughters and avoid the mismatch of the cloister. He actively encouraged fathers to remove their daughters from convents, and tacitly approved the use of force to that end. In 1523, for example, he praised a Torgau burgher, one Leonard Coppa, who had successfully plotted the escape of his daughter and 11 other nuns, among them Catherine von Bora, Luther's future wife, I needn't tell this group that, from their cloister at Nimschen near Grimma. Coppa regularly delivered herring to the cloister and apparently had smuggled the sisters out in empty herring barrels. Luther published a pamphlet account of this deed as an example for all parents with children in cloisters, and compared Coppa's freeing of the sisters with Moses' deliverance of the children of Israel from Egypt. He admonished parents to consider the plight of women who had been placed in cloisters while they were still, as he puts it, young, foolish, and inexperienced children. Age 6 or 7 was a normal age for noblemen and wealthy burghers to place daughters in convents. The great majority of these women, Luther argued, grew up to discover that they could not suppress their sexual desires and their need for male companionship in marriage. For Luther, only unmerciful parents and blind and mad clergy could permit girls to suffer and waste away in cloisters. A woman is not created to be a virgin, he declared, but to conceive and bear children. To document his charges against the cloister, Luther encouraged the publication of exposés by renegade nuns. One impressive example of which was the account of Florentina of Oberweimar, a noblewoman who had been placed in the cloister at age 6. Discovering at 14 that she lacked the aptitude for celibate vows, and so informing her superior, she found herself nonetheless forced to abide by the rules of the cloister against her will, suffering ostracization, ridicule, imprisonment, and even thrashings when she attempted to gain release. As far as Luther was concerned, opportunities for marriage abounded. The rapid marriage of large numbers of former monks and nuns in the 1520s was for him and his followers proof enough. Where the Reformation succeeded, new ordinances prohibited boys and girls from entering cloisters altogether. While a majority of monks and nuns already in cloisters were either pensioned off or returned to their families, and those wishing to marry, of course, receiving permission to do so. Throughout Protestant lands, monasteries and nunneries were in large part transformed into public hospices and schools, their endowments given over to charitable and educational purposes under joint lay clerical supervision. For Martin Luther and his followers, the stability of marriage and the family was threatened not only by the celibate ideal, which they successfully challenged, but also by the marital legislation of the medieval church. On the one hand, they accused church law of encouraging immature and unhappy marriages and fostering considerable social disorder and litigation by recognizing as valid so-called secret marriages. These are private unions by youth of canonical age, that is to say, 12 for girls and 14 for boys, without parental consent or any public witness. The medieval church had earlier sanctioned such unions grudgingly in an attempt, I think, primarily to gain control over rampant premarital sex and to bring marriage at its inception under the church's moral authority. Lutherans also accused the medieval church of impeding mature marriages by defining numerous impediments to marriage within an exceedingly broad spectrum of biological, legal, and spiritual relationships. Traditionally, the church had required a dispensation for a marriage to occur between couples related by blood or marriage as far as third cousins. Godparentage was treated as a spiritual affinity that prevented marriage between the godchild and the godparent and all the siblings and children of the godparent. A similar impediment was said to result from adoption. Nor could a Christian marry a non-Christian. Even defective eyesight and speech prevented a valid marriage in medieval theology. A blind and dumb person had to obtain a church dispensation to marry. Well, for Lutherans, the secret marriages of youth suggested a cavalier approach to the most serious of life's decisions and the most important human institution. When the honeymoon is over, warned the Eisenach Lutheran Jakob Strauss, and one has to contend with the body of a sick mate, then we discover how lasting is the fidelity of a marriage based on lust. In both Lutheran and Zwinglian territories, new marriage ordinances required both parental consent and publicity for a valid and licit marriage, which was henceforth proclaimed and recorded before witnesses in church. And lay clerical courts, dominated by secular authority, displaced the ecclesiastical courts in the resolution of domestic and moral conflict. These are basic and lasting institutional changes encouraged by the Reformation. Now, although Martin Luther opposed the private marriages of youth, he strongly defended the right of young people to marry whom they pleased. Learning of parents who had forced their children into unwanted marriages with unhappy consequences for all concerned, Luther devoted a special tract to the subject in 1524. As the title indicates, Luther believed that marriage should be a family decision, respecting the wishes of all family members, but especially those most directly involved. Parents should neither compel nor hinder the marriage of their children, and children should not marry without the consent of their parents. He advised youth confronted with what he calls the outrageous injustice of a planned forced marriage to appeal to secular authority for help if informal appeals through relatives, friends, or a sympathetic parent failed. And youth who found all such efforts unsuccessful were advised by Luther to simply flee to another land and there marry their chosen mate at will. As for parents confronted with a marriage they could neither willingly accept nor easily prevent or dissolve, Luther suggested that they state their objections frankly and then permit the marriage to occur without their approval, thereby letting obstinate children learn by experience the wisdom of parental counsel. Luther appreciated the difficulty of separating young lovers determined to be together and the futility of forcing two people to live together against their will. If, as he believed, men and women were supposed to find in marriage what he calls, and I'm quoting, the things they naturally desire, namely sex and offspring, a life together and mutual trust. Then to force two people together or apart against their will threaten both the purpose of marriage and the social order beyond it. As for the church's many impediments to marriage, Luther condemned them as only snares for taking money, and he derided those who dispensed them as merchants selling vulvas and genitals. He and his followers recognized only those impediments of consanguinity and affinity clearly set forth in Leviticus 18. This made it possible for Lutherans to accept such previously forbidden marriages as those between first cousins, step relations, and the siblings of deceased spouses and fiancés. Lutherans denied altogether the impediments based on such alleged spiritual and legal grounds as godparentage and adoption. According to Luther, and again I'm quoting, one may take as his spouse whomsoever he pleases, whether it be godparent, godchild, or the daughter of a sister of a godparent, and he may disregard those artificial money-seeking impediments. The politicians of the age were not, however, so bold as the theologians in domestic matters, and the laws and institutions of marriage did not, in fact, change as radically or as rapidly during the 16th century as many reformers deemed they might in the 1520s. The Reformation retained the biblical impediments. It rigidly supervised domestic morality through newly created marriage courts, and it became predictably more conservative in these matters with age. Nonetheless, lasting foundations were laid in Protestant lands for a more realistic and charitable approach to the requirements for a valid marriage. And new laws made immature marriages more difficult to contract, and mature and disciplined marriages became more secure and less vulnerable to arbitrary spiritual harassment because of the success of the Reformation. Spouses. When Martin Luther dealt constructively with domestic life, he frequently turned the traditional criticisms of women and marriage back onto the religious life itself, from which it had emanated, or so much of it had emanated. He baffled his opponents by describing marriage as the one institution where a chaste life could be maintained, and by insisting that one cannot be unmarried without sin. Nothing seemed to Luther a more natural and necessary part of life than marriage. Marriage, he disarmingly points out, and I'm quoting, pervades the whole of nature, for all creatures are divided into male and female. Even trees marry. Likewise, budding plants. There is also marriage between rocks and stones. End of quotation. He praised the early marriages at age 19 and the high fertility of the Israelites in the Old Testament. And he condemned contemporary women who appeared to detest motherhood for fear that the bearing and rearing of children might diminish their leisure. Our Savior Christ did not despise motherhood, he liked to remind the advocates of virginity and celibacy, but took flesh from the womb of a woman. Luther had an exceedingly high regard for the ability of women to shape society by molding its youth and civilizing men through the institution of marriage. As mothers, women fill the earth with life, while as wives they tame the beast within their husbands. A companionable woman brings joy to life, Luther told his table companions one evening. Women attend to and rear the young, administer the household, and are also inclined to be compassionate. Indeed, God has made women compassionate by nature so that by their compassionate acts, they may move men to be compassionate also, end of quotation. Martin Luther would have agreed very much with President Reagan that had it not been for women, we men would still be wearing animal skins and swinging from trees. Even when in jest, Luther seemed to be putting women down. He often bestowed upon them very high compliments. Once at table, for example, he declared, "Eloquence is not to be praised in women. It is more fitting that they stammer and babble." These unkind comments came after Luther had told a visiting Englishman, possibly Robert Barnes, who knew no German, that he, Barnes, should learn German from his wife, Katie, because Katie was the more fluent than he, the great Luther. Indeed, she was the most eloquent speaker of the German language, facundissima. On more than one public occasion, Luther described Katie as his lord. "I am an inferior lord," he would say. "She the superior. I am Aaron. She is Moses." Luther bore Katie's criticism of his poor business instincts and his misplaced charity with respect and good humor. Once he compared household wrath, as he puts it, that is to say, a fight with Katie, with the wrath of God in politics, where war and death threaten, and God's wrath in religion, where the soul and heaven are at stake, and drew the following conclusion: "If I can survive the wrath of the devil in my sinful conscience, surely I can withstand the anger of Catherine von Bora." His respect for Katie's abilities was also acknowledged in his last will and testament, where he scorned the German practice of appointing a male trustee to administer a deceased husband's estate, this on the grounds that women are not capable of running things for themselves out in the manly world of business and finance, and he directly constituted Katie heir to everything. Luther obviously meant it when he said, and I'm quoting again, "There is no bond on earth so sweet, nor any separation so bitter as that which occurs in a good marriage." His many comments on marriage leave the impression of an experienced husband who had given the matter a lot of thought. Take, for example, the following analysis. In the beginning of a relationship, he points out, love is glowing hot, fervidus. It intoxicates and blinds us, and we rush forth and grab one another. Once married, however, we tend to grow tired of one another, confirming the saying of Ovid, "Presentia odimus, absentia amamus." We hate the things that are near us, and we love those that are far away. "A wife is easily taken," he goes on, "but to have abiding love, that is the challenge. One who finds it in his marriage should thank the Lord God for it. Therefore, approach marriage earnestly and ask God to give you a good, pious girl or a good, pious boy with whom you can spend your life in mutual love. For sex alone establishes nothing in this regard. There must be agreement in values and character. Ut conveniant mores et ingenium." Luther here expressed a point of view generally shared by the marriage counselors of his day, both Protestant and Catholic. While physical attraction played an obvious role in the creation of a marriage, it was no foundation for a lasting relationship. All authorities agreed upon that. What held a marriage together over time was a mutual willingness to make sacrifices, a love of a different order. When seeking a spouse, then, the most important question was whether the object of one's desire was also a person worthy of respect and trust, a person with companionable qualities, and a person able to keep his or her word. According to Luther, both he and Katie had begged God earnestly for grace and guidance before they married. They had, in fact, had a long association with each other in Wittenberg between 1523 and 1525, engendering much gossip as Luther was a constant visitor at the home of Lucas Cranach, where Katie lodged. Luther twice attempted unsuccessfully to arrange other marriages for Katie, a renegade nun under his supervision. According to Catholic pamphleteers, who single Katie out as the model for the fallen nun, he and Katie had lived together openly and scandalously in Wittenberg before actually marrying. Whether or not there's any truth in this particular accusation, such practice was certainly not uncommon among clergy at the time when the right to clerical marriage had not yet been secured. The Zurich reformer Zwingli, for example, made public his secret marriage to a widow only a short time before the arrival of a child. For the clergy of the Reformation, the companionship of marriage, by which they meant regular sex and good conversation, was a major personal goal, certainly as important, I think, as their theological concerns. It was a reformation of men as well as of reformers and theologians. Because of the importance they attached to companionship in marriage, the Protestant reformers tolerated bigamous arrangements as a solution to loveless marriages. And they endorsed, for the first time in the West on Christian grounds, genuine divorce and remarriage. Although marriage was viewed as a spiritual bond transcending all other human relationships, it was no longer a church sacrament that created a once-and-for-all state. A marriage could definitively end the sight of eternity and a new one begin for separated spouses. In his earliest writings on such matters, Luther expressed great wonder, as he puts it, that people who had been irreconcilably separated because of adultery were not permitted by the church to remarry. Christ, he pointed out, and I'm quoting, permits divorce for adultery and compels none to remain thereafter unmarried. And St. Paul would rather have us remarry than burn. End of quotation. Traditionally, divorce had meant merely a separation of a couple from a common bed and table, not a dissolution of the marriage bond and the right to remarry. So long as both lived, a divorced couple remained man and wife and were so treated by law. And in practice, this meant that the turmoil of a failed marriage never ended for a couple. I've actually followed some of the cases in the 16th century in Catholic towns where men and women are separated from bed and table, and for the next 15 or 20 years are not permitted to remarry. And the chronicles of their lives are very sad ones indeed, often more sad for the men than for the women in this regard. In Zurich in the early 1520s, this issue came up before the judges in the marriage court, the Zurich Ehegericht. And the judges, in the most disarming, but I think also somewhat paradigmatic way for the Reformation, the judges said, "We've heard this argument presented to us today that there should be a separation from bed and table, and yet the people who are separated from bed and table should still be considered married." They paused and they said, "How can it be that people who are separated from bed and table, sharing neither affection nor conversation with each other, could still be considered married? For isn't it the case that people get married in order to share bed and table?" It's a very logical human syllogism. Protestants generally permitted divorce and remarriage on grounds of adultery, willful abandonment, chronic impotence, life-threatening hostility, and willful deceit. That is, when a presumed virgin was proven after marriage either to have given birth previously to an illegitimate child or to be pregnant by another man. This was willful deceit, and hence a solid ground for divorce and remarriage. A marriage had to be founded on honesty and trust. The whole theory of marriage was that you marry someone with companionable qualities whom you can trust to make the sacrifices required by the institution. Most Protestant writers sympathize with the position of the Strasbourg reformer Martin Bucer, who would become the main source, John Milton's defense of divorce and remarriage in the 17th century. Bucer, who declared no proper marriage to exist where regular sharing of affection and conversation had altogether ceased. Luther personally preferred secret bigamy to actual divorce and remarriage when a marriage had irretrievably broken down. He sanctioned bigamous arrangements as early as 1521 when he counseled a woman living with an impotent husband and unable or unwilling to take her case to the divorce court because of the intimate evidence required or because she feared notoriety. He counseled her to enter with her husband's consent a secret marriage with his brother or another mutually satisfactory person, and to raise any children of this second union as those of the impotent husband. Luther preferred such an arrangement to outright divorce because it ensured continuing support for a dependent spouse, while at the same time it prevented whoring and adultery by providing the healthy spouse a regular sexual outlet. If one spouse refused such an arrangement and the sexual desires of the healthy spouse remained overpowering, then Luther instructed the healthy spouse to remarry and flee to another land where they might live together as man and wife without prosecution for bigamy. Protestant marriage courts did not, however, permit divorce and remarriage to occur without first making every effort to reunite an estranged couple and revive the marriage. All concerned deemed reconciliation preferable to divorce in every case. Despite lip service to harsh biblical punishments, stoning for example, Lutheran pastors actually discouraged extreme penalties for adultery, lest the penalty itself drive an estranged couple even farther apart, as happened when an adulterer was punished by fines that impoverished him or by exile. All chance of reconciliation was thereby, of course, ended. Chronic adulterers, however, were treated harshly without much regret. When a table companion once expressed to Luther the belief that adulterers should be summarily executed, Luther quickly rebuked him with a local example of how harsh punishment had done more harm than good to a couple. He pointed to a pious wife in the community who had borne her husband 4 children and had never been unfaithful, but who one day committed adultery. For the transgression, her enraged husband had her publicly flogged. Afterwards, Luther, Pastor Bugenhagen, and Philip Melanchthon tried to persuade the couple to reconcile, and the husband was willing to take her back and let bygones be bygones. But the wife had been so humiliated by the flogging and the resulting scandal that she abandoned her children and her husband and wandered away, never to return. Here, Luther commented, one should have pursued reconciliation before punishment. Well, this was advice consistent with Lutheran theology and pastoral practice. Religiously and socially, no community was more fundamental than that formed by husband and wife. As the marriage bond was too important to be permitted to continue when all conversation, affection, and respect between spouses had irretrievably broken down, and instead of being defensive about divorce, in the Reformation tradition, divorce has a very positive, wholesome role. It's a very positive comment on the nature of relationships and on the importance of marriage. It was also too important. Marriage was also too important to permit it to die without a fight. My final section concerns children. Luther and his contemporaries prized fertility and were barely sensitive to the physically debilitating effects on women of multiple pregnancies, a problem in social history that many scholars are very sensitive today. Luther's age was one comparatively unthreatened by overpopulation, And both sexes view childbearing and child-rearing as womankind's divinely ordained vocation and penance for humankind's fall. Perceiving pregnant women to be both healthier and happier than barren women, Luther urged wives to be constantly pregnant. Even if women bear themselves weary or ultimately bear themselves out, he declared while still a bachelor, this is the purpose for which women exist, quote unquote. As an ex-monk who discovered the joys of marriage and parenthood late in life when he was financially secure and internationally famous, Luther was 41 when he married, he understandably scorned parents who did not view children as a blessing and showed little appreciation for the economic burdens placed on less fortunate families by too many children. But his role in domestic matters was always that of an advocate for the family, which he exalted in all its dimensions, utterly without qualification, against the defenders of virginity and celibacy whom he believed had maligned marriage and family for their own gain. I think in this context his remarks are neither extreme nor uncharitable. Luther's comments on children and his behavior as a parent belie modern studies that have associated the Reformation with negative feelings toward children because of its teaching on original sin and the bondage of the will. Luther, who fondly referred to his own newborn as little heathens, praised the faith and life of infants as the most perfect life on earth. And I'm quoting from Luther. The life of the infant, he tells us, is the most blessed and best. They have no temporal cares. They do not perceive the terror of death and hell. They have only pure thoughts and happy speculations. Whereas we old fools argue over the word of God, the infants believe it in pure faith without argument. Observing his own children at play one day, arguing and fighting with each other one minute, but reconciled and embracing each other the next, Luther commented, "How pleased God must be with the life and play of children. All their sins against one another are forgiven sins." He considered pre-6-year-olds especially susceptible to moral education and religious virtue because of the immaturity of their reasoning powers. With the advance of reason came the entrenchment of self-will and the cunning to plot against God, as Luther often observed in children who had reached puberty. Lutherans accordingly steeped young children in catechetical and moral instruction, apparently skeptical of the possibility of significantly shaping moral character after a child had reached puberty. Education at home and in school and church was designed to suppress selfish behavior and to encourage the development of altruism and self-sacrifice in the child. The goal was not, as some modern scholars have alleged, a child bereft of self-confidence and passively resigned to his superiors. In the Lutheran home, a disciplined child was one capable of transcending purely private desires and acting for the sake of others. That is to say, a courageous as well as a congenial child. In defense of government's right and responsibility to maintain schools for the civic and religious instruction of all boys and girls, Luther reminded parents that their children were more God's than their own. That is, they were subject to divine rules and expectations in their rearing. The creation of socially useful, responsible adults who are able to manage the world and to please God was a communal responsibility of parents, teachers, and magistrates alike. Luther, as you know, had 6 children of his own whom he subjected to very high moral standards and also to strict discipline. "My highest wish," he once confided at table, "is that none of my children become lawyers." A wish that expressed his identification of the study of law with vanity and social inutility, and lawyers like Jews and papists with a legalistic, self-justifying frame of mind that knew nothing of charity and faith. On occasion, however, Luther could be a harsh father. Once, for example, he punished Hans, his eldest, for an unspecified moral lapse by forbidding him to be in his father's presence for 3 days and requiring that he write a letter begging his father's forgiveness, to which letter Luther replied that he would sooner have his son dead than ill-bred. On the other hand, Luther urged parents always to discipline their children with forethought and caution, taking into account the unique personality of each child. He once explained his own entrance into the monastery as a cowardly act that had resulted from his parents' strict discipline, which had rendered him timid. He did not believe that the discipline itself had been wrong or the punishment undeserved, but he accused his own parents of not sufficiently taking into account the effect of their punishment on him. He describes them as failing to adjust punishment to his own peculiar temperament as a child, with the result that their discipline weakened rather than strengthened him. Proper parental discipline, he argued, should tailor punishment to a child's disposition, and it should increase his self-confidence while it inculcates correct behavior. If a parent's reaction to the death of a child may be taken as a commentary on parental character, then Martin Luther was a deeply loving father. When his daughter Elizabeth died at 8 months, he commented on his personal devastation. "I so lamented her death," he writes, "that I was exquisitely sick, my heart rendered soft and weak. Never had I thought that a father's heart could be so broken for his children's sake." End of quotation. The death of Madeline at 13 in 1542 overwhelmed Luther to the point that his faith in God failed. He wrote of it to his friend Justice Jonas, pointing out that while he and Katie should be thanking God that Madeline was now free of the flesh and the devil, neither was capable of doing so. "The force of our natural love," he writes, "is still so great that we are unable to do this without crying and grieving in our hearts and experiencing death ourselves. The features, the words, and the movements of our living and dying daughter, who was so very obedient and respectful, remain engraved in our hearts. Even the death of Christ is unable to take all this away as it should. You, therefore, please give thanks to God in our stead." End of quotation. Now, as a theologian, Luther taught that death was no match for a Christian's faith, that no proper Christian should be so overcome with grieving for a loved one as to give the impression that he had no hope. In 1531, as his mother lay dying, for example, he consoled her with the bold words, I'm quoting, "Should any thought of death frighten us, let us say, dear death, how is it that you are alive and terrifying us? Do you not know that you have been overcome by Christ? Do you not know that you, death, are quite dead?" End of quotation, end of question. Several months after Madeline's death, Luther scolded her still grieving brother Hans, who was extremely close to his sister. He scolded Hans for his inability to put his grief behind him and get on with his life as he must. Yet when Luther had to accept Madeline's death, his theology and faith proved poor consolation for the child he had lost. Returning home from a funeral, he tried to console himself by declaring that he'd always been more merciful to girls than to boys because girls need more care and protection than boys do, and that he now was glad to give Madeline to God because God would provide her with all the care and protection she needed. And then he adds, most pitiably, "But in my human heart, I would gladly have kept her with myself," end of quotation. Later, at the seemingly imminent death of his 10-year-old daughter Margaret in 1544, Luther commented that should she too die, he would not be angry with God, as he obviously had been extremely angry with God over the death of Madeline. I know of no other occasion in Martin Luther's life where his theology and faith had not been a match for the enemies who threatened him. He defied the emperor, birth of the modern conscience, German princes and several popes. He hurled epithets and allegedly also an inkwell at the devil. In the last years of his life, he shouted down a perceived international conspiracy of Jews, Turks, Papists, and bad Christians who threatened to undo his Reformation. His theology and faith failed him, however, at the death of a child. Now, some might find it disappointing that the great reformer could love a child more than he trusted God. On the other hand, the theologian and man of faith was also a husband and a father who believed and taught that no power on earth is so noble and so great as that of parents. Marriage and parenthood were arguably the most satisfying parts of Martin Luther's personal life, and the success of the Reformation was arguably most unambiguous and lasting in the domestic sphere. Accordingly, Luther could be angry with God when his parental dignity was attacked in so fundamental and inconsolable a way by the senseless death of his most beloved child. God, not the devil, was Martin Luther's great personal problem. Initially as a theologian and always as a man. You know, it's easy to understand that someone who is evil incarnate would hurt you, but it's quite impossible to understand why someone who is goodness itself would do so. As a human struggle, the temptations of the devil paled for Luther before the righteousness of God. The devil was a trifle for Luther, an easy foe to vanquish. One little word, namely Jesus Christ, slays him, as Luther pointed out in the great hymn of the Reformation. But the inscrutable justice of God was another matter altogether. For here sometimes Jesus Christ worked, and sometimes he didn't. Thank you.
Professor Osmond. We have a few minutes remaining yet, so again we'll follow our procedure and ask if there are any questions from the floor. Please.
What happened to the children after he died?
Oh, somebody always asks me that question. I don't have the foggiest idea.
The question was,
excuse me,
yeah, just for our people who could not hear, what happened to Luther's children after he died?
I really don't know. I wish I could answer your question.
If we know what ultimately happened to them, yes.
I do know that two died, two daughters died, but I'm not sure what happened to the other. I'm sure there are many people here who can answer this question fully, if I can.
The question has to do with the integration of public life and family life, which seems to be conspicuously displayed in Luther's career, but which seems no less conspicuously to be lacking in contemporary life.
I think the trick is that you have to marry Moses.
You can't...
I think the trick is that you have to marry Moses. I mean, it takes two very extremely strong individuals to do that, I would think, in the modern world. I am myself married to a 9-to-5-er, We travel each day 40 miles from our home in Newbury, Massachusetts, down to Boston with a three-year-old in tow. You have to, I can understand all of these sacrifices that one has to make to both work and to have a vocation and also to have a home life. But I suspect, as it is today, so it was then, he and Katie were flying by the seats of their pants and doing quite a good job of it. Of course, the Luther's home was organized in such a way that much of his work, the transit of people in and out, perhaps in that day and age, it was perhaps a little more, things were more centralized for him. But you would think with all the modern conveniences we have, it would be easier for us. That's all I can say. I do know that Luther continued to keep an icon of the Virgin on his wall until his death. I would think there would be this I'm reminded this famous statement in this forget the treatise in which this appears, where the treatise on the Magnificat, where he writes the exposition of the Magnificat, and he cites Mary as a great example of faith for all Christians. She's no longer an object to be revered together with the saints, or is one even superior to the saints, but she is she's the perfect example of how the faithful person should live. Here's this simple peasant girl who all of a sudden is told she's going to be the mother of God. This had to be an unusual and surprising and startling thing for her to hear. And Luther says, what does she do? An unfaithful person would run about, would go out and find somebody at Time Magazine or Newsweek, and some journalist, and start spilling the beans about this. But Mary doesn't do that. He says she goes about her work. She goes back in the house. She washes dishes. She milks the cow. She just does as a peasant girl should do. And this is the way faith is. Faith is nonchalant in the face of great honor, knowing that you are great Lord of all, as he says in the Treatise on the Freedom of a Christian. Your immediate response to that is to become a servant to all. And Mary becomes a great example for him. I think that's his Mariology. That's the way he looks at Mary, and I don't think there was any contradiction beyond that with her virginity that concerned him over much, but it's not a theme I'm expert on. I think the Reformation is a great distortion to which I think we subject ourselves when we don't remember that the vast majority of women at this time were professionally involved. Normally, when people from the lower and the middle classes got married, a woman would just continue. If she had a vocation before she married, she would continue it. It's often in chronicles of cities you'll find two people marrying. He is a carpenter. She's been selling fish and cheese. She will put her fish and cheese shop next to his carpenter shop. Or sometimes she will just join and work in his carpenter shop. The integration of the domestic responsibilities and vocational responsibilities on the parts of husbands and wives in pre-modern Europe is something that I think we tend to lose sight of, because we do tend to focus on noble women. Cloisters are there for noble women and wealthy women, who are by no means the majority of women in the society. And the Reformers thought that they were bringing women out of these cloisters, these noble women, out of these cloisters, out of idleness and sexual repression and cultural deprivation, and bringing them into the world and giving them these useful, constructive, vocational tasks within the home. These were single women who come out, become married women, and he does praise married women, as you say. But he's also very much aware, I think, of the domestic role that girl children play within a family, and the vocational role that women play in society. But you have to deal with him in his context. He is in a context of being an ex-monk dealing with ex-nuns. On the level at which he lives, he's actually very progressive in 16th century terms on this so-called woman's question, I think. Of course, from the perspective of the 20th century, nobody is quite so good as they should be, but we have to be a little more flexible in this regard. But it's really remarkable the the extent to which women were professionally involved, both single and married women, professionally involved in pre-modern Europe, and the confusion we have about that because we focus so much just on the noble women in cloisters and convents. This argument you hear often these days criticizing Luther, that Luther has taken away from women that one place where they could have authority and move in the world as autonomous, authoritative people and gain power and exercise power, namely the convent. Luther and the Reformers are very much aware of that argument. They address that argument expressis verbis, his argument appears, and they call it papist propaganda at its worst. I think that also reflects their awareness of the of this larger problem. I know Ian Siggins thinks that the mother's side of his family was where he got all of his brains and cultural contacts, and I have great respect for Professor Siggins, and I would say yes, it's read his book and swear by it.
I think the book is available outside, is it not, Ian Siggins? I hope the representatives of the presses are here to hear that.
We should be touting other books.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Osmond.